cover as many different things as possible and read everything. Read everyone. Read people you agree with. Read people you don't agree with. Read for how they are putting across their point. As a 7 foot tall, sweating, hulking, almost, you know, fire breathing dragon is staring at me, waiting to be asked some question from some 17 year old punk. I don't even remember what question I asked, but I remember thinking as I'm asking the question, this question is stupid.
This is the Work in Sports Podcast. Here's VP of Content and Engage Learning at workinsports.com, Brian Clapp.
I have a friend who doesn't have a smartphone. Old school landline, that's it. They get a little preachy about the reasoning. They see the addiction in other people and don't want that for themselves. They want to look around, not down. They want to be detached from responsibility at times. Listen, I get it. I respect it. In some ways, I admire it. But this person is also the first to complain about being left out of conversations amongst our friends. Not knowing jokes or funny moments, not seeing pictures of our kids. I'm not trying to call him out, not that he's listening. He doesn't have a phone. I mean, how's he going to listen? But he hasn't adapted with the times. As noted philosopher Bill Belichick has said, you have to do business as business is being done. Or maybe that was Jim Caldwell or Rich Kotite. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Probably a football coach over some period of time. Either way, the point remains, adapting and adjusting to market conditions is part of the human experience. Newspapers have faced similar challenges in adaptability over the years. As the rise of digital information sources and the immediacy of the internet has become the standard, newspapers that remained in the olden days have died. I loved the newspaper experience as a kid slash young adult. I'd read cover to cover, lay it out on the floor, get some pillows around me, digest every article, every box score, every column. It was a ritual that I enjoyed, but I don't do it anymore. I get all that and more from other sources in a much more immediate fashion. Newspapers as an industry had to adjust. They had to adapt. Some did. Some embraced the digital experience while leveraging their best-in-class journalism and reporting. Others didn't, and they no longer exist. I'm not saying my friend without the phone isn't going to exist, but I'm saying there is this tendency for us as a species and society to adapt or die. And that holds true in the sports business world as well. One iconic newspaper brand who has survived and thrived is the Detroit Free Press. And today we are lucky to have the sports editor of the Free Press, Kirkland Crawford, on the show. There is so much great info on the business of sports journalism, the importance of versatility and diversifying your products, and a really great lens on the business side of the sports industry. And a couple really funny stories about former Pistons center Bill Laimbeer. But I'll let Kirkland give you the details there. Here he is, my friend, Detroit Free Press sports editor, Kirkland Crawford. Kirkland, this is so great to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, Brian, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I absolutely adore your background, going through and doing some research into how you got to this point to being sports editor at Detroit Free Press. But let's start out at the beginning a little bit. When did you kind of figure this whole deal out? When did you figure out sports is my passion, this is something I want to do, and then couple that with the writing journalism side? How did you get to this point?
You know, I think it, as is the case maybe with a lot of these situations, it takes me back to my childhood, right?
Right. Like, hearken back to the early days.
Take a trip with me back to the early 90s. But that kind of is where it sort of started. So my first kind of memories as a child, not just sports memories, but kind of my first memories of a continuous stream were the Detroit Pistons, and most specifically the Bad Boy era Detroit Pistons.
I'm a Boston guy, man. So this hurts me a little bit to hear you saying this, but I get it. We'll reminisce about the Bad Boy era for a bit.
It took me 30 years before I could actually watch the Steal by Bird highlight. I used to turn away.
Oh, let's talk about that more. So that's one of my favorite moments of all time. That's my childhood moment right there.
I have a different perspective on that.
I bet you do. Wait, Laimbeer and Parrish fighting? Laimbeer and Parrish fighting? Bird throwing fists?
It would need to be both sides throwing punches for it to be a fight between Laimbeer and
Good
Parrish.
Good point.
That was, That was more of a mugging.
Mahorn and McHale. I mean, these were great times.
They were excellent times. And I think nowadays, especially with the advent of documentaries and things of that sort, we are able to better appreciate that history. And not only that history, but able to now better see how that history relates now to the modern day NBA.
Yeah.
All that said, the Pistons and that championship run left a great impression on me. I can remember watching game five of the 1991 NBA Finals, or excuse me, the 90 NBA Finals, staying up late at night to watch it, which was very important for a kindergartner for a 9 p.m. Eastern time start.
Oh, yeah.
To watch Vinnie Johnson's jumper from the right side with 0.7 seconds left.
The microwave.
Was huge for me and you know, six-year-old me at the time or whatever it was. So my early dream of, well, I'll just become a Piston one day. I'll help carry this tradition was quickly squashed when realizing that they weren't drafting grade school children. But in that time frame, I was able to notice that there was a group of people that were sitting literally in the front row, not just even the paid front row, but on television at what was the scorer's table right in front of all the action. And I asked my father, well, who are they?
Yeah.
You know, he explained, well, a lot of those folks there are journalists, that they're writing and covering and discussing what's happening in the game and telling the world about it after the fact. And I think at that moment, the proverbial light bulb went off in my head, and it just went, well, that's what I want to do. I want to be in that particular number. And that's that thirst for knowledge on the teams that I grew up following here in Detroit has not gone away, quite frankly. And I've been able to carry that as a career goal of mine basically since second grade, basically since that time of wanting to be a working sports journalist in many different capacities. And certainly nowadays, we all know that basically if you're doing one thing, you're doing 500 other things within this field. But I just wanted to become as much a part of that group. Even that dream took over the idea of wanting to actually play. Whether it be basketball or baseball or football or hockey or whatever the case may be. I wanted to be the person telling the world about what was going on with those teams. And thankfully, I've been able to have a job in that pretty much since I have almost wanted to.
So you got that career clarity early. And I think a lot of people, that's a struggle. They get this broad idea of, I want to work in sports, but they don't know necessarily what that means. But I was looking back, and I mean, you were involved in the Free Press apprenticeship while in high school twice, from what I understand. That's really an indoctrination into what the industry means, really seeing it and living it. What do you remember most about those experiences, and how did that kind of frame you to be the person and editor that you are today? How did that set you up?
The fortune that I've been able to benefit from comes from a lot of different areas. Part of it being certainly the Detroit Free Press and the relationship that they had at the time with Detroit Public Schools. There was a high school journalism program that was funded in part by Ford Motor Company, which, of course, is as big as it comes when it comes to commerce here in the state of Michigan. So what they were doing was more or less bringing in 10 to 12 to 15 different high schools, public high schools in the city, and basically helping produce their student newspaper. It almost has served in a way as almost like a pseudo farm system, more or less, in the years past. I mean, some of the top, you know, journalists kind of in the country have emerged from this program. Jamel Hill was a graduate of Mumford High School.
Wow.
Nicole Christian, Marlon Walker, who is a top editor now. Many of the stars of this program have moved on to become journalists, not just at the Free Press, but across the country. So it sort of went from there to, if you're really, really interested in this field, the Free Press still continues, thankfully, an apprenticeship program with high school students throughout the, which has now kind of been expanded to much of southeastern Michigan, more or less. Whereas if you're a high school student and you're really, really voracious about trying to become a journalist, the Free Press provides an opportunity for folks to more or less kind of get their feet wet. You know, they interact and intermingle with the editors and writers and photographers and producers that we have in the newsroom. And it's a wonderful opportunity to not only just get published, but just sort of become exposed to the daily ins and outs of the field, whether you're interested in sports or news or whatever the case may be. So those, that opportunity for me back in the summer of 2001 and 2002 was confirmation, really, more than anything else, that this industry is what I want to be a part of.
So getting that experience outside of just sports and the craftsmanship that goes into writing and storytelling in other realms, is that advice that you'd give to people trying to break into this industry now, to maybe not be so just singularly focused on the sports journalism side, but to branch out a little bit and get that extra layer of experience?
Without a doubt. Okay. The necessity, especially as you're young, is to hone your craft as a storyteller. And even as we alluded to earlier, honing your craft as a storyteller in as many different mediums as possible, whether it be the written word or the spoken word or video or photojournalism, because again, all of those avenues kind of meet at the same intersection nowadays, and you need to have a trained eye kind of in all of those. I mean, even in my capacity now, I help produce podcasts, a part-time photo editor for all of our photo galleries that we produce. Writing newsletters are different from writing news stories, which are different from editing columns, which is different from writing chatter on social media. So all of those disciplines are necessary nowadays in order to become as marketable as possible. And even in that entire spiel, I said nothing about sports. And it's important because sports is as much covering news and covering business and covering politics and covering weather and understanding statistics and trends and social media, certainly. So covering sports is more than just, you know, Tom Brady, whether he's going to retire or not. It's the impact of what that means to Central Florida and the entire NFL and what he does next and what his next contract with Fox Sports means, and understanding his connection to this area here at Michigan, or in the state of Michigan, because of his college career as a Michigan quarterback. So understanding all of those different avenues in life are extremely important, and really the only way to learn those is to actually do them.
It's rare for someone to go through the experience that you have, where you grew up in an area, you went to college in that same area, you got an opportunity for a career in that same area. In the media world, we're so used to relocation. I mean, I grew up in Boston, moved to Atlanta for my first job, moved to Seattle for my second job, moved to Denver, live outside of Philly now. I've been all over the place. And I think that tends to be the norm. I think it's exciting for you to be in that market that you have so much legacy knowledge of, and that history and that background. I mean, that gives you all that nuance that I think is so important as a journalist. But take us through that first opportunity getting hired at DFP. I mean, you were the first web producer back then in 2007. So what was that like? How did it go from apprenticeship to now I'm full-time employee? And what were those initial responsibilities?
So it serendipitously coincided with the Detroit Tigers and their first run of success in almost two decades. We'll take you back again, as it were.
I love it. I do. This is my era.
The summer of 2006, in which the Tigers, sort of out of nowhere, 3 years removed from being the worst team in American League's history, were contending, were good which was foreign not just to me as someone, one of the rare people of my age group who actually paid attention during that time frame.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've watched 1990s Tigers baseball, which was quite literally a time suck. But still, that team took this area, this state, by storm. That summer also was when I finally graduated from Central Michigan University after 4 years with a BA in Broadcast and Cinematic Arts and a minor in Journalism. And after trying to get hired at other places, I more or less came home and asked slash begged for any opportunity there with the Free Press. And at that time, the Free Press was also doing what was called community free presses, where they were basically doing hyper local sections of their paper in certain community or certain suburbs throughout the metro Detroit area. So I started doing, as a freelancer, work in the Livonia, Westland, Canton area. And then also going back to the what's called the prep crew, taking scores from high school football games and so on and so on. Luckily, many of the people within the sports department had known me for years, including the sports editor at the time, Gene Myers, and the upper management above him as well. So when it was becoming quite clear that the Tigers were going to make the playoffs, though they only got the wild card after leading much of the regular season, the American League Central Division, that's a different story for a different time, but they had to make some adjustments to their to the Free Press's sports staff. So they moved one person from agate editing mostly to copy editing.
Yeah.
And that inherently created a position for me on a part-time basis to become an ag editor, which for many people in the newspaper industry is the entry-level position, especially when you're doing sports. So that moved along throughout the fall months, and we just sort of let, you know, they allowed me to continue to do that into the winter. At the same time during the winter, I also went and interviewed for a job at the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, which is about 3 hours away from here down in Indiana. And it's a place I actually interned at in the summer of 2003 after my freshman year in college. When I came back from that interview, the sports editor at the time, Gene, told me not to do anything. Give me 3 days.
Okay.
I said, okay, no problem, Gene. I wouldn't be here without you. I'll give you 3 days. No problem. In that span of 3 days, Gene was working to create a position within the sports department that would mostly focus upon the website, which, of course, at that time was only gaining in popularity exponentially.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know how Gene kind of got it signed. It was just sort of almost like the trick you do with where you're a kid and you're getting your progress report signed and your parents don't really even know what's happening. But by January of 07, I become a full-time member of the Free Press Sports Department, still doing agate and then also starting to understand how the website fits into our day-to-day operation. So, yeah, I kind of got snuck in, and they haven't stopped paying me since,
more or less. No, I mean, by 2011, you were the first sports web editor, 2017, first sports digital planner, 2019, sports deputy editor, and now sports editor. I look back sometimes to those early days of my career. Like I was saying, I was at a national sports network and I was editing highlights and I worked from 7 at night until 3 in the morning and I was working weekends and holiday. I loved every minute of it. It was crazy. I loved every minute of it. When you were first getting started and you were on staff and you were web producing and there was all that upside there, was it immediate? Like, this is great. This is what I expected it to be. Or was it different than what you thought it would be?
I was in awe.
Yeah, me too.
Quite frankly, I was in awe. I'm watching the proverbial sausage get made in a ridiculously busy sports town where there is just constant movement. There's constant change. There's constant, something is new that's happening here all the time. And watching these professional writers and editors, photographers, decision makers shape the way in which we cover what's going on. And then in contrast to that, also watching the change of how sports media is practiced.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started there, there were three print deadlines. The last one was 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
And the lament was, why haven't the 10 o'clock baseball scores moved on the wire yet? why hasn't the horse racing track called us with the results yet?
Yep.
Like, those were the things in which we were really concerned about. And that's certainly not the case anymore in terms of our office, for better or worse. I marveled at the idea that the newspaper, even, you know, even today, it's sort of the website, is this blank canvas. Mm-hmm. In the morning, it starts as this completely blank canvas, and then slowly yet surely, every day, whether 1,000 things happen or quite literally nothing happens, we have to fill this canvas up. The beauty of a Metro Daily sports department is that you can always fill it with something. And the challenge is filling it with something that's going to make somebody want to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And translating that now to want to engage with it on social media or want to click on it on our website or on your mobile app or whatever the case may be. So that daily challenge and watching how the decisions are made at each level, from the top level within the sports department to the lower levels within it, trickling all the way down to how am I going to fill this 3-inch gap on our agate page? What am I going to put here? I was just in awe of watching it happen every single day.
Was there a moment when, you first start interviewing athletes or being around the athletes and you're in that kind of a world, that subculture, that ecosystem, and that's a big shift going from fan to reporter, journalist on payroll as well. I remember that one of my first interviews, I interviewed Ken Griffey Jr. And I swear I had it in my mind. And it wasn't like a one-on-one sit down. It was kind of a bigger session, but anyway, it doesn't matter. I kind of had in my mind that we were going to end up like friends later. Like, he was going to like me and we were going to hang out. And like, you know what I mean? Like, you just have it in your thought process, and it's bizarre. Like, looking back at it, I laugh now, but was there a weird realization once you started getting into that ecosystem of how this whole system works?
So I'll tell you a story. I had just graduated from high school. I knew I was going to Central Michigan and spending the summer months at the Free Press. I went on an assignment with George Sipple, who later became a colleague of mine, a good friend. We went to the Palace of Auburn Hills in the middle of the day to cover a Detroit Shock basketball game.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it was against the New York Liberty, but that's not the point. The point is that in that time frame, just like a week or two before then, Bill Laimbeer had been hired as the interim coach of the Detroit Shock. So I'm sitting on press row. I'm sitting in the seat that I saw as a 7-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching a professional basketball game and watching Bill Laimbeer, who I had revered, who we had talked about earlier, coach and scream and yell and be Bill Laimbeer for 40 minutes on the sideline. And then after the game, I walk with George. We go into some hallway or whatever the case may be at the Palace of Auburn Hills. And we're in a scrum with Bill Laimbeer.
Yeah.
And there's 5 or 6 different journalists there and someone with a camera at the time. And everyone asks a question. And in the midst of everyone asking a question, it pops in my head, oh, I need to come up with a question here, don't I?
Yeah, right. Oh, wait, I'm supposed to be doing stuff here too.
I'm working.
So I'm not just fanboying right now. I'm supposed to be working.
So then I try to figure out, well, what am I going to ask him? Because folks are asking pretty good questions. I mean, it was a relatively ho-hum game.
Yeah.
So then I think Bill looks at me, waiting for me to ask a question. And then it's like I'm having this out-of-body experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm watching myself with my mouth agape as a 7-foot-tall, sweating, hulking, almost, you know, fire-breathing dragon is staring at me, waiting to be asked some stupid question from, he doesn't know me from gym, but
yeah,
from some 17-year-old punk who drew his jersey 10 years beforehand.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what question I asked, but I remember thinking as I'm asking the question, this question is stupid.
I bet you remember the look he gave you. That's probably emblazoned in your memory.
I remember the look he should have given me, which was what? And stormed off. So as I'm wrapping up the question, I'm then mentally preparing to be embarrassed because Bill is going to go, what? Blankety blank, and then storm off. But he didn't. To his credit, whether he read or smelled the shyness and just deer in the headlights look that I was giving him, he answered the question. He said something. I'm pretty sure I used it in the story because I went, well, I don't care what he says. I'm going to use it in the story. It's getting in there. And then after I wiped my brow and shook off whatever scared butterflies I had in my stomach still, and then went into the locker room and asked some of the players a couple of questions, including Swing Cash and Deanna Nolan, who were on the team at the time. Then we drove back and I wrote the game story.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, man, it's got to get better than that, right? The interaction with professional athletes has to get better.
Yeah.
And it did. It did. I mean, even at that time, famed Hall of Fame baseball broadcaster Ernie Harwell was writing a column for us. And occasionally he would call the office and our sports editor would let me relate to him whatever message there was for him, just so that I could say that I went to work today and talked to Ernie Harwell on the telephone. And unmistakably so. I mean, his voice was the voice of
iconic.
God.
Yeah.
Certainly here in this area. I mean,
just nationally. Yeah.
There's no mistake. He had to. He even said, "Well, this is Ernie Harwell." And in my head, I said, "Yeah, no crap. I know it.
No kidding. Yeah.
But yes, sir. I'll get right on whatever it is you need me to do." And those sorts of interactions have gotten better.
Yeah.
I did have. I interviewed Isaiah Thomas a couple of years ago, and after the interview, once we were done, I did profess to him his impact on my life at that time after we were done everything like that. But I didn't want life to go by without him
having that
knowing
moment.
Or being told. Yeah. And I'm sure he hears it a bunch. I mean, he's, you know, on the Mount Rushmore or whatever sort of group or list of things you may want to put together. But, you know, that team and those, again, it goes back to that impact being a major factor in what I do today.
Yeah. No, I think that's, I love these stories because I do think that there's a, when expectation meets reality, there's always that kind of conflict or disconnect. And you're like, oh, this was a little different than I expected, or a little better, or a little worse, or it changed over time or whatever. Yeah. So I always find that fascinating. I kind of outlined your career a little bit, a lot of those stages of development and the path you've taken at the Detroit Free Press. Deputy sports editor to sports editor. That seems like it would be I know it's just one word, but that seems like it would be a pretty big jump in responsibility, in burden, in some of those things. How would you describe the responsibilities of the role having changed over the last few years of you as you've gotten to this top seat of sports editor?
Well, I try not to eat that proverbial elephant, you know, aside from just one chunk at a time. Because, I mean, there's a lot of responsibility with it, especially in the way in which the Free Press and at large, Gannett has sort of changed is trying to change the model in which we kind of are profitable, right? Yeah. And that's kind of the ugly underbelly of the industry in and of itself. Like understanding that as much as you'd want to do all these cool things and be a part of the local conversation, help drive the local conversation with the teams that millions of people adore amongst these, you know, six major fan bases that we are responsible for. We got to make money on it, right? And, you know, the city of Detroit has four hallmark franchises in the four major professional sports leagues in our country. And we also cover University of Michigan and Michigan State University, which are two brand names when it comes to college athletics. So the fan bases span across, you know, from sea to shining sea and abroad. In fact, we get letters and emails from our friends in Canada who are eager for more Red Wings coverage. So that responsibility to make sure that we are being fair and being insightful, but being critical when necessary, but being fun when necessary, is something I don't take lightly, because it's what got me hooked into our industry. You know, that my, the dream could have died with just, well, I don't want to do that. That looks, that seems hard.
Yeah.
But the first, one of the first stories I remember reading as a kid was about, funny enough, Juwan Howard, who, of course, now is the head coach at the University of Michigan for basketball. Yep. When he was a player, of course, with the Fab Five, there was a story written about his recruitment and specifically coming out of Chicago and how Steve Fisher and Brian Dutcher had a big hand in that recruitment. And that story was written by Mitch Albom.
Yeah.
Now I'm Mitch's editor.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Just still a trip.
Yeah.
So I try to think that there's somebody out there my age or then who is potentially interested in this industry.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that that what they are walking into is as impactful and as important and quite frankly is still around when they get to that point, because it was around when I got here.
So much of this leans back into the sports consumer and the audience itself. I mean, we've seen demand change. We've both dealt with it throughout our careers. Sports consumers have changed. Attention spans are like a minute. Mm-hmm. Is that hard to always be? I mean, you talked about it earlier. You start with a blank page. You got to fill it up. You start with an audience that wants social and video and podcasts and written word and all that. Is that part of the fun challenge or the frustrating challenge to always be finding that magic formula that will capture attention, bring people in, make them stay, pay the dollars so that you do have that business relationship as well? Where do you sit on that? Is that part of the fun or is that part of the frustration?
It's honestly, it's both. It is a fun challenge when you know that you've prepared a section or when you have edited stories together or you're in the middle of this big story or big game and you know that the audience is coming to you first.
Yeah.
Or that they are extremely interested in what your team is saying about their team. That can be fun. That is, there's an adrenaline rush there that's, you know, I think relatable to anyone else who deals in whatever field they may be, whether it's, you know, healthcare or politics or whatever. But there are times when you feel like you're killing it.
Yeah.
And it's the tree falling in the forest.
Yep.
And so then you have to try to almost constantly self-evaluate, you know, are we doing this too much? Well, we've always done it this way. Well, well, does that mean that we have to continue doing it this way? And if the audience is moving away from that, what is the audience interested in? Mm-hmm. And it's, I liken it a lot of times to sort of almost like preparing a meal or running a restaurant. Right. And you want to try to make sure that your patrons are getting as many fruits and vegetables as possible.
Yeah.
But fries are great. And fries work.
They are.
And fries are awesome.
They're amazing.
But if you are a industry, if your company only serves fries, your audience is going to stick with you a long time because they're going to just expect fries from you all the time. So that when you are providing this great four-course meal, there's not an not necessarily even an appreciation level for it, but there's not an appetite for it.
Right.
So the fun and the frustrating part can be trying to find this balance in, hey, today we have fries, but tomorrow we're going to have spinach.
Yeah.
And we're going to make some great spinach. We've been making great spinach for hundreds of years. And you may not like the spinach,
right?
But you need to eat this. And it's our responsibility to provide this for you, even though we know you're going to buy fries. So that becomes the ultimate, you know, do you do what's best for subscriptions and page views, or do you do what's best for satisfying the journalistic soul?
Yeah, being the paper of record and having a responsibility and agenda setting and being the gatekeeper and all those great journalism terms that we all learned. Yeah.
The challenge becomes, how do you serve all of those different masters?
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is that you can, in spots, a little bit, but you can't be it's much more difficult, especially nowadays, because, you know, as when we started, staffs were bigger, budgets were bigger, attention spans were longer, as you mentioned. So now that all of those sort of great fortunes that we've had have all decreased in one way or another, how do we still be a relevant and solvent entity that can turn the lights on and make payroll?
Yep. It's the ongoing challenge. I think another massive change that I think we've all witnessed too is that, again, when I was coming up in the industry and I'm working at a national sports network, we're going to the newspapers to find out what's happening in their region, right? Sure. Teams would go to the newspapers to get their message out there. Now there's been this massive shift where teams are having their own content teams. They're having their own websites. They're having their own networks. Athletes are using their own personal brand to get news out there, to break their own stories, to leverage their own behind the scenes stories and video content, and build their own personal brands. How much a challenge has that become to be able to be not just exclusivity, but having interest and being able to access information gathering and be able to be out there with something that people haven't heard before? I just think that the challenge now has got to be so much more robust.
It is, because the competition for audience is extremely, extremely robust. Because when, as you mentioned, in just take the Detroit Lions, for example. Once upon a time, it was just our paper, the other in-town paper, a couple of television stations, right? Radio stations, right?
Yep.
But now it's all of those. Plus, as you mentioned, the Lions have a really good social media staff, and they have hired two former newspaper reporters as kind of their own sort of journalistic arm.
Yep.
Many of the players on those teams have their own social media channels, whether it be Twitter or Instagram or TikTok or whatever the case may be. And that's just the competition for just that entity. And then there's also the competition, because we operate on different platforms, not just the tangible print standpoint, but certainly because we're in the digital space, we are competing with YouTube and these six or seven different streaming services for television in terms of time. Again, all those other social media platforms. So that the competition for attention is diverse and ruthless. Yeah. Quite frankly. So yeah, that's a challenge. What we've tried to do is leverage what's unique to us. What's unique to us are our vantage points and our voice.
Yes.
And in some cases also our access. Dave Burkett, who is our beat writer for the Detroit Lions with the Free Press, who I think is the best beat writer of any sport in the country, provides analysis and insight and expertise that I don't think anybody else in the country can provide. And we have, again, columnists, whether it be Mitch Albom or Jeff Seidel or Sean Windsor or Carlos Menares, who have differing and unique thoughts and analysis upon what's happening in the major things that go on here. So we're able to provide that level of unique expertise. That's our advantage. You know, is it enough? Some days, yeah. Some days, not quite. And, you know, how do we supplement that, you know, from the desk standpoint, what can we do to help boost who we have and add some extra flavoring sometimes to what we are already providing. That becomes the daily challenge. Yeah. And it's something, again, as we mentioned before, it can be fun, but when the teams aren't good, as has been the case from the professional sports scene here for way too long than I'd love to consider, it can be a challenge.
Perfect example of what we're just talking about. Literally, as you're answering this question and as we're discussing it, I get a notification on my phone from the Patriots, because I'm a Boston guy, from the Patriots saying, exclusive content. We sat down and interviewed one-on-one with Bill O'Brien, new offensive coordinator. Perfect example. The team's owning that rather than we went to the Boston Globe. But I will also say, I think a lot of sports fans still know their local paper and that brand is the established voice. So like when I really want the credible information, I go back to those sources. I go back to the Boston Globe. I read from those sources. I know they're embedded. They're there. The storytelling matters. Their professionalism, their credibility, that matters. And it's not just, I heard this walking down a hallway, I'm going to throw it out on my blog. It's legit. So I think there's so much value in that still to this day. I want to spin this forward. I want to be respectful of your time. I know we've had a lot going here, but I love this conversation. I think there's so much nuance to the sports media landscape. But let's give some advice to those younger sports journalists that are coming up in the industry now. You broke in as a web producer, and that has vaulted you through your career in a lot of different ways. And you got started early, but what are those first entry-level positions that exist somewhere like at the Free Press? Or if somebody wants to break into sports journalism, what are those pathways that make sense today, now? What does that environment look like out there?
It's, again, still extremely competitive, and that part of it has not changed over time. There are many different sort of avenues in which we have sort of tried to find talent in terms of creative and effective storytelling and trustworthiness. If you think that that avenue is sort of just creating your own blog, I mean, you're sort of taking almost the Bill Simmons approach, which, you know, is from your neck of the woods, that avenue is like a... It's like a crowded freeway.
Yeah,
there are a lot of cars there, and it's very tough to navigate in terms of getting into, you know, getting onto an off ramp that you're interested in. I think what's most important is, again, being able to hone your skills from a storytelling standpoint, whether that be starting as a small reporter at a smaller paper when you get started, trying to cover everything, even if you're in. If you're in college or community college or whatever the case may be, covering everything.
Yeah.
Also, not being reckless on social media, as hard as that might be as a teenager or an early 20-year-old.
Yep.
Thankfully, that device was not around necessarily when.
Thank goodness, right? I would have gotten myself in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Because if I'm going to hire you, if you're sitting across from me and we're interviewing you, that's the first thing I'm going to. I'm going to every one of your social media channels, because bringing you on is a representation of our building, of our institution, which is going on 190-something years. And even if you're on a barley and hops infused rant at 3 a.m., it's not random person on a rant. It's random person from the Detroit Free Press. On a rant. And the last thing that we're interested in trying to do is try to explain away someone's overserved rant at, you know, an ungodly hour of the day. Because it will come up to us because of our audience is just as active on social media as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I would say, you know, be careful on social media. Cover as many different things as possible and read everything. Read everyone. Read people you agree with. Read people you don't agree with. But don't read them whether you're trying to reinforce some confirmation bias. Read for how they are putting across their point. Is the argument good? Or is the evidence of which they're using, is it valid? Are they getting it from some... you know, tinfoil hat covered kook, or are they really using legitimate sourcing? How are they coming across that sourcing? Is that sourcing just, as we like to call them, one of our great sources in the world, Wick IPA-ta? Or is it someone that's actually hit the ground and actually done the work?
Yep.
Being able to identify the real versus the artificial is very important, because once you're able to identify that as a young journalist, you're able to then – that comes across in your writing.
Yeah.
So I read everything, man. If you're interested, if you're even a bit interested in politics or nature or science or whatever the case may be, or business, money, read it. Read it constantly. Yeah.
I think that's amazing advice. Kirkland, this has been such a fun conversation. I think we could go on so much longer. There's so many different issues we could continue talking about, but I want to be respectful of your time. You got a busy world to cover.
I've only gotten 3 phone calls in the meantime, so it's...
I bet. The phone, I'm sure you're getting a lot of people wondering, how do we handle this? What do we do here? So anyway, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Brian, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks again.
Thank you to Kirkland for coming on the show today. Such a refreshing take to hear his perspective on, you know, do I go after clickbait that I know will get a lot of views, or do I hold the line on our journalistic integrity and making some of those decisions and kind of finding those balance points of relevancy and new platforms to engage with? Such an important way to look at our industry as a whole, because things are always changing. That is the one constant. I've been talking to people in the office about ChatGPT all the time. That is something that is going to change the way we develop and we build and we create content. So you have to adapt with these things. And it's cool to hear Kirkland share his stories about adaptation and what happens to free press now and into the future. Plus, it's kind of exciting to think about, you know, Lions are kind of a fun team. They've got a young team with the Pistons. It's just got to be fun to cover right now. So there's always that too. Thanks for listening, everybody. Love having you here. It's an important part of how we grow. So please continue to rate and review. That helps us remain high in the podcast rankings so different listeners can discover us. And just subscribing and sharing with your friends means the world to us. Thanks, everyone. I'll see you on Monday.